Hi, I'm Cynthia Cortman Westfall, a Broadway music director, voice coach, and tenured professor in the musical theater department at the University of Michigan.
And I'm Chelsea Wilson, a performer turned voice teacher to Broadway stars and vocal coach on Broadway productions like The Phantom of the Opera, School of Rock, and more.
Here on the Broadway Vocal Coach podcast, you can expect real talk about the business, practical advice, and constant encouragement.
We believe there's space for every artist in this industry. All you need is the right support. So consider us your two-woman hype team. Welcome to the Broadway Vocal Coach podcast, where we help musical theater performers get unstuck and take the next step in their careers. Today on the podcast, we are very excited to be welcoming a dear friend and fantastic voice teacher, coach, all the things, Sarah K. Brown. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Our pleasure. We have so many juicy vocal health and vocal technique topics that we cannot wait to get into with you today. But first, for those of you who don't know Sarah, let me just introduce her. Sarah is a singing teacher and a licensed speech pathologist based in New York City, and she's the owner of SKB Voice Studio. Her specialized combination of singing background, performance experience, and clinical expertise have enabled her to serve Tony-winning artists, Metropolitan Opera singers, and TV film actors. She knows what she's doing, my friends. Before going into full-time private practice, Sarah maintained a clinical caseload at the Voice and Swallowing Center of Mount Sinai for 5 years, as well as an adjunct faculty position at Pace University. She regularly presents educational lectures on vocal health and performance. Her research has covered a wide variety of topics in voice, swallowing, and upper airway disorders. In 2022, her study on training graduate-level SLP students in voice therapy was presented nationally at the Fall Voice Conference. When not fulfilling her mission to make vocal technique and voice therapy more accessible, Sarah herself enjoys performing on a regular basis. A classically trained soprano who performs as a crossover artist, Sarah earned a Bachelor of Music degree in vocal performance at Chapman University. She later earned an MS in speech-language pathology from Northwestern, where she focused her studies and training in voice rehabilitation. Sarah holds a certificate of clinical competency in voice pathology and is trained in level 1 and level 2 Estill voice. And in 2020, she was awarded a distinguished early career professional certificate by the American Speech and Hearing Association for her impact on the voice field. How lucky are we to have you here with us today, Sarah? Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks.
That's so nice.
There is no one I would rather talk all things nerdy voice stuff than with you.
Thanks.
I feel like I should go back though. Sarah and I became TikTok friends in the early days of the pandemic. In 2020, both of us got on TikTok and I just was like fangirling over all of her content. I was like, yes, she's so smart. I love what she has so to say about the voice, all these things. And so we connected early on and we've met up in New York when I visited and I just think you're great. So thanks for being here virtually with us on the podcast.
Oh my gosh. Well, thanks so much for having me. Obviously, I have a ton of respect for both of you. So I was super stoked when I got the email.
Yes, perfect. Sarah, so obviously as an SLP and a voice teacher, would you maybe first define for our listeners what an SLP is? What is a speech language pathologist and what's their role and responsibility in like a singer's world?
So it's interesting because speech pathologists obviously do have a lot of crossover in knowledge and expertise as singing teachers do, but there are some distinct differences. So a licensed speech pathologist is someone who has done an undergraduate degree in speech pathology or post-bac work and then gone on to go get a master's of speech pathology. And then in the States, we also have to do a clinical fellowship here. So there's a lot of training that goes into becoming a licensed speech pathologist, and they typically work in a clinical setting. So, for example, I worked initially at a voice center in New York City. I was working alongside laryngologists and doing more voice rehabilitation. So this is a short-term course of voice therapy, potentially with injured singers, like if they have nodules or a polyp or something. We act as the short-term clinical care for that and helping to restore a singer to their baseline function. So if they have lost function from an injury, our job as a speech pathologist is to help them get back to their baseline. And then where a voice teacher usually takes over is helping them max out their vocal potential. So they're already at their baseline function and they're ready to take their voice as far as they can go. That's the job of the voice teacher, who then works with students for a long-term period of time rather than that short-term rehabilitation phase. And of course, there's also some speech pathologists who do singing teaching, like myself, and then singing teachers who have some additional mentorship and experience in clinical work. So they're able to sometimes step in a little bit earlier to the rehab process and be part of the team too. But I think that a speech pathologist, a great voice teacher, and a great laryngologist are the three people that any singer really needs on their team.
Can you differentiate too? What is the difference between SLP and a laryngologist?
Oh, yeah. So a laryngologist is a physician and a speech pathologist is not a physician. So they are not a doctor. They're a clinical therapy physician. A laryngologist is a voice specialized ENT doctor, ear, nose, throat doctor. So if you want to become a laryngologist, you have to do your residency after medical school in ear, nose, throat or in otolaryngology. And then if you want to specialize in voice, you have to do an additional year of laryngology fellowship training to call yourself a laryngologist. And so I definitely recommend for singers, if they have the option between a general ENT and a voice specialized laryngologist, to go see the laryngologist. Their equipment is usually a little bit more specialized or fancy for the singers. Their experience is going to be a lot superior. I think they're going to have a lot more experience with that laryngology fellowship year. And then what they can offer potentially surgically is also going to be more advanced than a general ENT.
How do you suggest people, maybe not in large cities, go about finding a great laryngologist in their area? Because I totally agree that extra level of specialty makes a huge difference, right? Especially if you're a professional voice user, to go and see someone who has that level of expertise. So are these laryngologists generally associated with like research hospitals or university hospitals? Or like how might one find a great practice?
That's a great question. So the resource that I like for the United States is through, I think it's the University of Iowa has something called like a voice care team database online. And so I think that's a really good starting place because these are different practices that self-identify as voice specialists, but it usually includes laryngologists and speech pathologists. And they have them listed by state and then by city, which is a great place to start if you're looking for somebody in your area. Because at the least, even if you only see a speech pathologist listed there, you could probably contact them and find out who they normally refer to in their area, for example. So I think for the United States, that's probably the best option is starting with that list. I think it's called the Voice Care Team Locator through the University of Iowa.
That's awesome. Sarah, wow, so many things to cover. So many things I want to ask you. Maybe let's start about how you got started and decided to pursue a career as an SLP. As we heard in your bio, you got an undergraduate degree in vocal performance. And then at some point you were like, let's be a clinical speech language pathologist. So how did that come to be? Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, totally. So back when I was in college, I was training in opera. And around my junior year, I was starting to have these kind of wild voice issues. I was creating two tones at the same time, which was really impressive. If I was doing it on purpose, that would be very impressive. It was not happening on purpose. And the thing that was so tricky about it is that there was no injury. So people couldn't really figure out why that was happening or what was going on. And I actually went to a general ENT and they didn't really have the specialty to kind of figure out that further. They were like, maybe it's mucus or something. It was not mucus. And I just felt like I wasn't really getting better. And clearly this was not the time to pursue singing professionally. So kind of at the end of my junior year, I decided to look into speech pathology as a potential career path, thinking that, oh, maybe I can still train my voice while I pursue and set up this other career. And then that way, when I'm done, I can kind of decide what I want to do with speech pathology versus like trying to get back into professional singing later. So that was what made the decision for me to go into speech pathology. So I ended up at Northwestern, and I was really lucky that I started working with a teacher there who was actually able to help me restore function to my singing voice. It turns out it was all kind of just muscle tension, and I was just very discoordinated in how my vocal folds were trying to come together. A couple things set me up for that. A lot of sinus issues and just like pushing through that, you know, really made me prone to muscle tension stuff. But my vocal folds at baseline are also a little bit asymmetric. So that just makes me a bit more prone to potentially being more tense without kind of careful consideration of register balancing and things like that. So fortunately, while I was doing my speech pathology training, I felt like my singing voice got a lot more functional. And it was interesting too, because the teacher I was studying with at Northwestern, she was using a lot of the tools that I was learning about in voice therapy. So like she was using things like SOVT work. She was talking to me about, you know, kind of tongue tension and some different anatomical considerations that really hadn't been presented to me before. And these are the things that actually really helped restore my voice. So it was cool to kind of see that happen at the same time, while it was stressful, obviously, at the time. In hindsight, it's cool to see how those experiences were kind of running parallel to each other. So I moved to New York City after grad school to take a clinical fellowship position with Mount Sinai and ended up staying on the team and kind of did a really solid 5 years clinically there. I ended up specializing in rehabilitating injured singers, but I also did general voice disorders, so like speaking voice work. I also did chronic cough therapy, which is an interesting one to work on, as well as swallow evaluation and therapy. And I think the well-rounded experience was really nice too, because it informed my understanding of the anatomy beyond just as a singer. I was being informed about the anatomy of cough, the anatomy of swallow. And so my understanding of the instrument, I think, was improved by that, even though those things sound unrelated. And I happened to pick up a couple of private singing students while I was working clinically. And kind of the rest is history. That kind of happened at the same time I started posting on social media. So between word of mouth from those three initial private students, and then also building somewhat of a following on social media over, I don't know, the last 2 years, I was able to build up enough of a studio to go out on my own completely, which has been really fun and kind of a dream come true, like a dream come true that I didn't even know I had until it was already happening.
Yeah. Do you still maintain clinical clients as well, or is it full-time voice lessons and voice teaching?
Yeah, I would say it's probably about 80% voice teaching, although of course there is some overlap because a fair number of the voice centers in New York will refer singers to me who graduated from voice therapy and are looking for singing voice training. So there is some overlap there within that 80%. And then I take probably about 20% still some clinical work. I like to keep my skills sharp in that department. So I'll usually try to keep a few more clinical cases at the same time, just so that I can keep my speaking voice training skills up to par.
Well, yeah. With that then, what are some recurring themes with your clients, you know, now that you've really moved into the voice teacher space, in addition to your clinical background, like, what are you consistently working on with your clients and students from a vocal technique or even a vocal health standpoint? What comes up again and again?
Totally. So there's a few things. One of them is overbreathing. Especially working with singers at the professional level, I think they've had, you know, 10 to 15 years of training. And so much of that early training is so focused on breath that sometimes when someone comes out of college, like they're just trying to breathe so much right before the high note, which is not helpful. High notes typically need less air, not more. So there's a lot of kind of breath retraining of just like getting them to breathe less. So that's one of the big themes I see. One of the other ones is, especially like that post BFA training, making sure that those 22 to 25 year olds who are just out of school are really prepared for the industry and being trained across styles. At least for a lot of my students, they're called in for soprano one day and for a straight up pop rock belt the next day. And so making sure that they're cross trained and equipped for musical theater. The industry just kind of at this moment demands that you're able to do a bunch of different styles. The one technique thing that I see so much in my post BFA musical theater trained singers is their tongue and their soft palate are a little bit discoordinated and kind of tied up. I think that there's a misconception or there's confusion about how to make a bright sound versus what is a nasal sound. And so they've been trained really bright, which is fine. Like the brightness is, you know, can be a really helpful thing for efficiency, but it tends to accidentally be over nasalized. And so then that can functionally create a lot of issues with airflow and like using too much airflow, or aesthetically also if it tips there, that might not be what the student wants either. But I think functionally it really can impact how easy a voice feels. So we spend a lot of time like learning what their tongue and their palate feels like and being able to actually kind of control those somewhat on command so that they have a much better understanding of what is a nasal bright sound versus what is just a bright sound but not aggressively filtered through the nose.
Mm. That's so fascinating, because I think something that I see a lot recently is singers who are really fixated on, okay, well, it feels bright, so then it must be nasal, right? Like sometimes people have that in their head and they're terrified of sounding nasal. And so So sometimes the opposite happens, right? And they try and go really dark or back or hooty or whatever to avoid that. And so that's fascinating to think about, that that's coming up a lot for you, being able to distinguish this is bright and a lovely resonance place versus this is going nasal, whether or not you know it. But you need to know it so you can control whether or not that's your choice or whether it's just happening without your conscious.
Exactly.
This is my big pet peeve of what so many singers, I feel like, come to me with this idea of, I'm trying to sing forward, I'm trying to have it in the mask. And it's like, well, which seven parts of your anatomy are we talking about that you're trying to make bright forward through the mask? I feel like some of those sort of general notes that we've used for a long, long time are finally, with some vocal science, starting to be parsed out and unpacked and individually packaged, you know, so that we aren't conflating seven things all into one. Because that's a big one, the nasality and twang and a high larynx. So, like, there's so many different things that might be contributing to brightness or not brightness. And I think a lot of people mix all that stuff up.
And I think when you really know the difference and you know how to make all these different colors across what you're doing with your articulators and all your structures of resonance, plus how you might apply that to different styles of singing too, is, I actually think, really empowering for a singer rather than like gatekeeping that information and thinking that it's going to be too much for them to understand. I actually think them being trained with that information is really helpful, because then hopefully they can coach themselves a little bit, even when they're not in a lesson, because they can think about ways that they can check for nasality or not, you know, or ways to explore brightness. Yeah.
With that, what are some other misconceptions that you see and hear about the voice and vocal health, especially being online and being in an online space where you're sharing a lot of fantastic and science-backed vocal health information? What do you see is maybe not so factual, or just misconceptions that singers have, and even maybe voice teachers have too?
Yeah, totally. I think one of the biggest ones is that there's actually a lot of nuance in how we train speaking voice as speech pathologists. And to get a healthy or efficient speaking voice, it doesn't always mean that it needs to be higher pitched or that it needs to be jammed farther forward. Yeah, that's just as like kind of a general statement. I think there are misconceptions about what healthy and efficient speaking voice is for a lot of people. A lot of people kind of think, oh, it's got to be this like really bright thing and like got to speak a little bit higher. And that's actually like a lot of effort to do that and can lead to some really weird strain patterns. So that's one thing that I think, if you are having speaking voice needs at all, I would recommend working with a speech pathologist who specializes in voice. Not all speech pathologists specialize in voice, but working with one who does, just to figure out what for your voice that you need, and not just some of those general statements about like speaking from the mask or speaking from the diaphragm or something like that. I think the other one that pops up sometimes on the internet as well, like, what are the magic cures for a sick or swollen voice? And unfortunately, at this point in time, to my knowledge and what I was trained and what I've been exposed to, there aren't proven magic cures and quick fixes for a swollen voice, kind of other than steroids. So if you're sick, really the best things for your voice are the simple things. Always start there. So increase your sleep. Rest your voice. Don't push it. Stay extremely hydrated. You could be steaming. You could be nebulizing. You can even do gentle vocal exercise, assuming that it feels helpful for your voice and not making it worse. If it's making it worse, don't do that. But, you know, some straw bubble work or lip trills or something like that can feel helpful to the voice when you're sick. But those simple things are truly the best things. There aren't like magic fixes. I think some people kind of get on different like ideas about supplements and things like that. And if you're into that, that's fine. But I would definitely consult with a physician about it, specifically your laryngologist, just because we don't have a lot of research on vocal fold hemorrhage, but there is a thought and kind of a general consensus that certain supplements and medications, if they have blood thinning effects, could potentially put you also at risk for something like a vocal fold hemorrhage. So pushing through with your voice when you're sick can put you at more risk for just injury in general. Yeah. But some of the misleading content I've seen online sometimes includes like, take this supplement for your voice when you're sick, take this tea, take this medication, take this thing. And some of those things you just want to consult with a doctor about, because it's those kinds of like supplements and medications that we don't have a lot of research about, but potentially could put you at risk for vocal fold hemorrhage if they have blood thinning effects, for example.
Yeah. I just appreciate you saying, Sarah, that if vocalizing feels good, then to go ahead and do it. It's kind of one of those things like, you've got to keep the muscles, the folds moving just a mm-hmm. little bit. And it also allows you as a singer to kind of gauge each day if you're improving, if you're feeling a little bit better. So I love that. I think that combination of vocal rest, but then a really mindful check-in with the lip bubbles, the straw work, you know, slight vocalizing can be really helpful. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Totally. I think it's important to note that complete vocal rest is not a typical recommendation for voice injury in general. And then even if you're sick, again, if you gauge it on, oh, this is actually helping a little bit of movement might actually be more helpful than not.
Can you talk just a little bit more about steroid use? I feel like in recent years, we've gotten a little bit better with taking care of ourselves as singers, and that if you have to call out because mm-hmm. you're sick, you call out. Back when I first started, you know, people were taking steroids in order to, you know, the show must go on at all costs. I saw a lot of really tragic things happen with singers and too much steroid use. And at the same time, I've also seen it really helpful to get over a little hump, or if there's a really crucial one night performance you're trying to get through, or a weekend of shows. I've seen it both in students, you know, in like a college setting, and I've seen it on a number of the Broadway shows that I've worked on. But could you just talk a little about when is steroid use helpful? And when can it potentially tip into a more harmful thing for singers?
Yeah, totally. So obviously I'm not a doctor, so I'm not the one prescribing steroids when they are prescribed. The ideal situation, the gold standard situation, would be to probably be prescribed steroids by your laryngologist. And that would be in conjunction with them scoping you and actually seeing what's going on. I think that that would be the gold standard of, like, if you were going to use steroids, that's how they'd be prescribed to you, rather than picking them up from an urgent care doctor where you're not being scoped as a part of that process. And so you may not even know what's actually going on with your voice. So yeah, definitely consult with your laryngologist and probably have them scope you if you're thinking about starting steroids. I think where it gets tricky is when they're used long-term and it ends up being more of a band-aid solution for something else that's a chronic inefficiency or a chronic problem, and steroids are kind of covering that up. As you spoke to, you know, if it's like a more one-off thing, a short-term solution for either like a really high-stakes performance or a short period of time that someone is needing some help at the guidance of their laryngologist, that's totally fine. But I think when people are kind of chronically on steroids and it's actually covering up voice technique that's not as efficient, and that's why they're getting chronically swollen, I think it's better to not use them as a band-aid, because eventually that can catch up with you. And there are risks to using steroids also, the way that they can affect the body. So it's just something that needs to be under the advisement of a doctor. And as a short-term thing for a one-off, not a big deal. As a band-aid for a long-term vocal technique issue, that's more of a problem.
This leads me to one of my next questions, which is, you know, when is it time to go see an SLP or a laryngologist? Singers, how do we know when it's just fatigue, or I'm overworked, or I'm just getting over a cold, or nope, now's the time to go see a doctor? What would you recommend?
So I would definitely recommend already having your voice care team set up, get your care established, have your baseline healthy, like what you feel like your healthy is, vocal scope done, so that we know what you look like when you're feeling good. Because, for example, even in my own voice, like I'm a little bit asymmetric. It's really helpful to know that, so that in case I ever have a voice issue pop up, they're not going to call the asymmetry and be like, oh, you must suddenly have a paresis or something, when we already know that I'm asymmetric at baseline. And so kind of the same thing. Some people are already actually a little bit swollen in the midfold, and that actually may be their healthy baseline. So knowing that when you go get scoped and having that comparison is super huge. And then in terms of when to go, if you're having a current problem, I would say it kind of depends on how severe the problem is. Like, for example, if you ever just completely lose your falsetto or head voice or kind of that upper register and it's pretty much essentially gone and it happened very suddenly and isn't associated to some kind of cold, that's one of the classic case histories for a vocal fold hemorrhage. So that would be a great time to go be seen immediately if you do have that severe sudden voice change. The nice thing about vocal fold hemorrhage is that as long as you catch it, you can recover from it pretty well. It's when you don't catch it and keep singing on it that it's a problem. So yeah, that sudden severe voice change, great to get scoped pretty much immediately if you're a singer. The other kind of general rule of thumb for like a more mild problem would be about 2 weeks. So if you're having a mild kind of fatigue and issue, like let's say you're coming out of being sick and you're just like, okay, I'm still getting my voice back, it's fine. Give yourself maybe up to about 2 weeks. And if it's still sort of persistent, I might go ahead and get checked out at that point and just make sure that you're not doing further damage or something by continuing to sing while recovering.
In my capacity with Institute for Vocal Advancement, the voice teaching certification that I work through, I do a lot of mentorship for other teachers. And this is something that I end up sharing a lot to other teachers and even newer teachers is don't be afraid to recommend to your students that they go see the voice doctor, you know, and go early, go whenever you think. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of teachers and singers have this trepidation about going, like, if I make the appointment, then something really must be wrong, or it's got to be this like really, it's a big deal. It feels like a big deal.
Yeah.
But I really think it's so crucial, if we're speaking to voice teachers in this moment, to not be afraid to recommend that your students go, because we all, as the voice care team and a voice teacher on that voice care team, just need more information. And mm-hmm. the fact that you could go and get scoped and see someone who is going to literally look at the vocal folds and give a professional doctor opinion, like, we need that information as voice teachers just as much as the singers yeah. need it, so that we can all work together on a solution. And it doesn't have to be like a big traumatic recommendation from the voice teacher to suggest that. I just think normalizing the fact that we can just recommend that you go, let's just go get some more yep. information, is always totally. Helpful.
Yeah. And that's such a casual way of describing it too. It's just like, we need more information versus yeah. I think there are some singing teachers who will be like, I think there's something wrong and I think you have an right. injury, and like start so accidentally unhelpful. Like pre-diagnosing people before yeah. they're even scoped. And like mm-hmm, yeah. that very casual, I just need more information. You know, I think it'd be really helpful for us to know this. It's just such an easy, friendly way to talk about it without accidentally like also pre-diagnosing something without a scope or a medical license.
Yes. Yep. Yep. Yep.
And could you even normalize a little, like, if we're talking about a singer who is potentially going to be singing for 50 years of their life, 60 years of their life, when we think about athletes who get injured, we don't really shame them for that. It's a part of the job. If you're going to do a high impact sport, chances are you're going to have some injuries over the course of a career, especially if you have a long career. What would be quote unquote normal for someone to expect over the course of decades of singing? Can they expect to never get injured? Is there something that's sort of a normal occurrence that chances are you will deal with this or that over the course of a long-term singing career?
That's such a great question. And I don't know off the top of my head any statistics. I think there are some centers in the city maybe doing like statistical research on how often vocal injury happens in performers, and I do not know the data off the top of my head. I do think it would be unrealistic for a performer to expect that they would never have some kind of voice problem over a several decade career. And of course, that problem could look like a lot of different things, whether that's a viral laryngitis that has something to do with them getting sick, or some kind of injury from a high vocal demand or high vocal quantity use situation. I think it would be unrealistic to expect you would never have anything happen to you. I do think having more access to education about vocal health would probably help with prevention of some of those risks being mitigated. So for example, having that baseline scope already done, knowing your voice really well for like what your signs of swelling are and what your signs of like, ooh, she's a little crusty today are versus, you know, a more severe symptom or something. But I know, for example, in my voice, kind of like what my full range is, if I'm starting to gain a lot of notes on the bottom, or if the tip top is a little bit off and a little bit like sketchy, I guess you could say, I think the chords are just not wanting to phonate an onset very easily. That's my cue, like, oh, I'm kind of swollen. I need to be a little more chill, a little more conservative. I might not go to that dinner tonight and reschedule it for a different night instead so that I'm not overusing it. So I do think with access to vocal health education, having that baseline scope and being really on top of it with like knowing your voice and more proactively seeking care rather than like waiting until it's a really big problem might help minimize the risk of more severe injury. But of course, things also do happen. You know, 8 show a week is like insane. Like that's a lot of voice use.
I feel like this is where the shame factor comes in sometimes, is that if someone has an injury, there's some stigma or shame attached to it because they must have done something wrong, or their technique isn't good, or their voice teacher didn't steer them in the right direction, or something to that effect. And how singers, I feel like, often think it's their fault versus like a basketball player who sprains their ankle. Like nobody says, oh, your running technique in the court is terrible. You know, you better work on your technique more. Yeah. It's like, no, sometimes injuries just happen.
I greatly, deeply wish as a whole for our industry and our field that there was less stigma and shame around vocal injury. It's way more common than anybody thinks. And also, it is very rare that I see a professional singer in office for a scope, or back in the day when I was doing that, it's very rare that I would see a professional level singer with textbook chords. Very rare. Often there's a little something going on. There's a little fullness, a little stiffness, you know, some kind of subtle sign of some wear and tear over the years in most professional level singers. So it's also just knowing like, it's extremely common to have some subtle wear and tear, even if you're performing extremely well and feeling like you're at the top of your game. So I really wish deeply for our industry that there was less shame and stigma. I think we ask our professional level performers, they're doing extremely athletic things every single week. And so they're at risk for injury, even if their technique is perfect, just simply because of the quantity of voice use. They're at risk for injury. It's also complicated because there are a lot of variables that go into vocal injury. It's not even always the singing technique. More often than not, it is the speaking voice technique, which, like, why would you have ever thought about your speaking voice? You know, it's just not something we think about. And so speaking voice technique can be a big one. If someone has like some kind of day job on top of performing, like that's also a lot of vocal use that sometimes is out of their control a little bit. So there's a lot of variables of how somebody could get injured that are beyond someone's singing technique. So I just think taking the stigma and shame down off of that would be great for everyone involved. And it is a really hard conversation that I have with singers when we are talking about injury, because we do have to talk about enough things that they have agency over and can hopefully help to improve their situation. So we do have to talk about what are the things that can maybe set you up for better efficiency across the board so that injury hopefully will heal, hopefully less likely to happen in the future. But walking that line of like also not making them feel like it's their fault, because it's also not, you know? So like even if there are things that they can take agency for after being injured, it's not like they were purposely doing those things.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And I think also just acknowledging the like the speaking voice, and especially when we think about theater and musical theater, which there is so many demands in the scene work on top of the singing. Oftentimes the singing can be the thing that a singer feels like, oh yeah, I can do, I've been training to do this for 15 years. But when I have to stand on a table and scream my top volume and then run around the stage four times, like you're not physically prepared for that. Your speaking voice isn't physically prepared for that. So those are all things to just be kind to yourself. And just acknowledge we're constantly learning, and depending on the demands of whatever show you're in, your voice will have to adapt and grow to like accommodate those roles.
Yeah.
Sarah, I think also belting can get a really bad rap in our industry. And I'm curious if you've got thoughts. What are your thoughts?
Totally. I do have some thoughts about this. Interestingly enough, I was trained initially, I think the first thing a teacher said to me about belting was that you either can do it or you can't. That's what she said. It's like either you can do it or you can't be taught to do it. And then later was told that it was unhealthy. So both of those things are not true. Belting can be done efficiently. It can be done healthily and sustainably. But I do think one of the things that makes it so confusing and controversial is that nobody really agrees on what belting is. I don't think if you asked like a bunch of singing teachers in a room what they thought belting was, I don't think you'd get the same example or the same explanation from each of them. You'd get something different. And as singers, we can actually use that to our advantage, because belting does not have to be one thing. There are so many acoustic strategies that you can use to sound like you are approximating that belt style. There's a few things that, you know, the audience people hear and to their ears will make something sound beltier. I mean, one of those things is being loud relative to your own voice, sounding relatively spoken or like having a spoken quality, and then also having a high emotionality to how you're singing. As long as you kind of hit those three variables, there are a bunch of options to approximate those three qualities to make it sound kind of belty. It does not have to be a full throttle chest voice situation at all times. And it always is so funny when a student comes in and I'm like, oh yeah, that sounds great. Like that sounds like belt. They'll be like, but I feel like I'm in head voice. And I'm like, that's how you feel. That's okay. But mm-hmm. it matters what the audience hears out here. And you might have felt some sensation of flip or thinning or mixing or whatever you're feeling in your body. But as long as the audience is perceiving it as the belt style, it doesn't really matter how you got there. So you should choose the acoustic strategies that serve your voice the best, because that's going to be what's healthiest or most efficient long term, is like figuring out how your body produces those sounds. And we all experience sensations inside ourselves when we're singing differently than other people too. So like yeah. one person may have a different sensation of what feels chesty or not, and that'll be different versus another person too. And I think that's partially why it's so confusing to describe it, is because everybody experiences it in their body differently for how to create these big sounds.
That's so crucial. I was talking with a singer this week, actually, and she was like, she's trying to work on more of a chest dominant sound feeling, trying to get more of that belt style in her singing voice. And she's like, well, when I listen to Kelly mm-hmm. Clarkson, it just sounds like she's doing X, Y, or Z. It sounds like she's just singing in her chest voice. And that's again where our perception of not mm-hmm. only our own voice, but other singers' voices get in the way.
Totally.
We hear mm-hmm. Kelly Clarkson, and it sounds like, in air quotes, she's singing in her chest voice to mm-hmm. F above C. You know, and that's likely not true. That's probably not how Kelly Clarkson perceives her own voice, right?
Right.
And so we then want to copy and paste what we are perceiving in other singers in our own voice.
Totally.
Which is unhelpful as well. So I really appreciate that. Everyone perceives their voice differently. There are so many strategies to get that belty style, that belty quality. And when it's good, it often feels so much easier than we initially perceived
Totally.
I wish that for everyone. I wish that for everyone.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Sarah, one more question for you. If all singers knew this thing, it would make a difference in their singing. What could you leave our listeners with here?
Another big soapbox. I really think that if all singers knew how much their tongue impacts their vocal production, we would all be saved a lot of headaches in terms of singing training and how we grow our voices. And this is for a few different reasons, but if you think about anatomically how the tongue exists in your vocal tract, it actually attaches to the top of your larynx. So then already, we know that it's going to be kind of influencing how your larynx functions, because it literally attaches. And it can affect resonance and things like that, but I also think that it affects pressure as well. And we see this on swallowing exam. I mean, a big part of how we push food down is with our tongue pulling back and like pushing the food down with a pressure. And so all that to say, because of those things anatomically, it can affect vocal production a lot and the sensation of effort. And so I think that where it gets tricky is a lot of teachers will identify, oh, you've got some form of tongue tension going on or some form of tongue issue going on, but then they don't have anything to give the student, which is tricky. And so I'll have singers come in and say, I know I have a tight tongue, no idea what to do about it. And there's actually a lot of really simple things you can do to assess for if you would benefit from tongue work, whether that's stretching the back of your tongue, whether that's doing a tongue out trill, or even just singing through something with your tongue out. If any of those things make your voice feel a little freer or feel a little better, you probably would benefit from some tongue work. So I think it's the thing that when I get students, I assess it first thing with everybody, and it never ceases to amaze me that like it's not talked about with the majority of the people who come see me.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I agree. I will die on the hill of that tongue. Yeah. It's a,
right?
It's a big one.
I would die on that hill.
I will die on that hill. That tongue. Oh.
Yeah. There's just so many practical things you can do about it, So it's not like it needs to be this mystery things. Like we can see it, we can feel it, we can like actually explore it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to link in our show notes then some examples of you, stretching the tongue, doing some tongue work on your social media, because I know you've shared some really great things about that.
Thanks.
I love that. Sarah, amazing. Thank you so much for being here with us today. I have learned so much, and I just feel like I agree with everything you've said and shared, and I think our listeners have so much to gain from this. I really appreciate you dispelling, some common concerns or some common myths. How can folks connect with you online? Where can they find you?
Oh, yeah. So I am on Instagram, Vocal Health SKB, and TikTok, also my website. So SarahKBrownVoice.com.
Perfect. You've got associate voice teachers now as well, right?
Do you I do.
You guys taking new clients if people are in the New York City area or looking?
Yeah, we are actually. We do some in person in New York and then also online as well. I have two speech pathologist singing teachers who work with me, which is great for people if they have some vocal health concerns. And then also a singing teacher who's more performance oriented. So for those who need vocal technique, but also like audition prep and acting stuff, she covers a lot of that too.
Very cool. Okay, well, we will link all of that so people can connect with you if they haven't already. Thank you for joining us, Sarah. This was such a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
If you enjoyed today's episode, take a screenshot wherever you're listening to this episode, share it and tag us on Instagram at B-Way Vocal Coach. Share it with a friend and please consider leaving us a review. And by consider, I mean press pause and leave us a review. And if you're ready to take your next step as an actor, but you aren't entirely sure what that should be, take our quiz. We'll strategize with you to outline a roadmap to your unique goals. Plus, from there, you can book a free consult with us. Visit bwayvocalcoach.com/take the quiz. We can't wait to hear your story and help you take the next step in your career.